Good morning. Please be turning to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, we are looking at the first discourse of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew, which is the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And last week we looked at the Beatitudes and going down through verse 16. And so this morning we're going to begin in verse 17 and take a look at this sermon that he preaches. The main, I guess, theme of this sermon can be found in verse 20, where he says, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, last week we talked about the fact that he's going about preaching the gospel of the kingdom of heaven and how the Jewish expectation of what the kingdom was like, the characteristics of the kingdom, and the characteristics of the people within the kingdom were far different than what Jesus brings here. And that is really manifested in the way the Pharisees acted and behaved and what they taught. As we said a couple of classes ago, though, let's understand where the Pharisees were coming from, that their intentions were really good. When they and the Sadducees and the Essenes, when they evolved, it was in that period of this major upheaval and unrest and trying to do what was right until they received some type of prophetic word from God. God had been silent, no prophet, no message from God for close to 400 years. And so there's a lot of debate about the application of the law and how they are to go about doing things specifically underneath Roman oppression when they can't really function and exist the exact same way that the law speaks of. And because of that, there are misapplications, misunderstandings, and wrongful attitudes about the kingdom and about the righteousness before God that Jesus has to correct. And so when he says in verse 20 that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven, that would have been a particularly shocking statement to the people, because the Pharisees were considered as the religious elite. It would be similar to a very good, faithful gospel preacher and excellent shepherds of a congregation whom everybody thinks is doing the right thing, teaching the right thing, talking the right way, behaving the right way, and Jesus comes into that congregation and tells everybody else in that congregation, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the preacher and the shepherds, you're not going to enter into the kingdom of heaven. Yes.
Or is it just the
Pharisees? Good question. Adam said, is there evidence that the regular Jews thought the Pharisees were top-notch, or was it just the Pharisees themselves that thought they were top-notch? Both. Yes, the Pharisees thought they were top-notch. But the regular lay people, yeah, they looked up to the scribes and the Pharisees. They looked to them as the leaders, the spiritual leaders. When people went to the synagogue, it would be the Pharisees that would be doing the majority of the teaching and the instruction, the commenting on the various readings that they had. So they were the ones that were looked up to. And so for, again, the Jesus to come in and say, unless you are better than, unless your righteousness is greater than the preacher and the shepherds, whom, you know, we're talking about those people who generally people have a view of as their righteousness is way up here. And then Jesus says, you got to be better than that. Really? Because if that level that the Pharisees are at, if you think that that's really good, what's the implication of the Pharisees by that statement in verse 20? They're not good enough. So therefore, they're not going to be entering into the kingdom of heaven. That level of righteousness is not good enough. Jesus raises the bar big time with this sermon and with that statement. So that's going to be a major, major issue, of course, throughout all of Jesus' ministry, is this contention between himself and the Pharisees. And, they don't particularly like being talked about that way. And so they attack him in many ways, of course. But, for instance, take a look at the end of chapter 5 as an illustration of this, or what it is that Jesus is getting at. When he's talking about the way we treat our enemies, he says in Matthew 5, verse 48, that if you behave in the way and act in the way that I'm telling you to behave and act, therefore you shall be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect. Not in the sense of sinless perfect, but of course you will be complete. You will have fulfilled what it is that God has planned for you to be and how you are to be. So that's the goal. It's not the Pharisees' level of righteousness. It's the way God is. That's the standard. So that bar has just been elevated. Yes, sir.
Mark, when he speaks to the Pharisees, is he speaking as a sect versus the Sadducees, or is there a special office he's speaking
of? He's specifically talking about the sect of the Pharisees and their general mindset. Now, he is painting with a broad brush. That doesn't mean that every single Pharisee, of course, was a hypocrite or anything, but he is speaking generally of that group of individuals. And he rarely has any run-ins with the Sadducees. That's an interesting study on its own, but most of the time it's the Pharisees that are the ones that cause him the trouble. Danny? Yes.
And what you see in these Pharisees and these scribes.
Yeah. Yeah, the external, what Danny is saying is the Pharisees were very concerned with external appearances. Jesus is focused on the internal man. That's exactly right. And he hits that hard in here in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew 5, 6, and 7, and also in the last discourse, which is also a very long discourse, and specifically chapter 23, where he lays into them and he talks about how outwardly they appear as, do you remember the illustration? As whitewashed tombs. Okay, well, a whitewashed tomb, it may look pretty on the outside, it's all clean and so forth, but what's inside? You're full of dead men's bones. And so, that's what the heart of what Jesus is getting at is the heart, is the internal man. And so the Pharisees' mindset, and we're going to see this with the murder, with adultery, and with all the other stuff Jesus is getting at the inside.
I'm just going to add to what Dan said. That's something that I'm afraid we are very guilty of still today.
Yeah.
Being concerned with the outer appearance. So, we're kids ourselves so much. Because as you mentioned, your speech is everything we do and say.
Right. Yeah. Bruce is saying that we can be, and we are, just as guilty as the Pharisees in being concerned with externals and not changing the inside. And I think that he's right on that, that is God sees beyond that. He is going to be the judge of that. And so as we lambast the Pharisees, let's make sure we understand that we're a whole lot more like them than we care to admit. Let's not be, you know, too hard on them in the sense that we're not looking judgingly upon them without considering ourselves. The scribes and Pharisees hadn't raised the bar high enough. Jesus is trying to raise that bar, but we want to do the same thing, don't we? Don't we want to lower the bar of righteousness?
Yeah.
Don't we want to lower the standards? Doesn't that make it easier? Okay, now y'all know where that phrase comes from about lowering the bar or raising the bar, right? The high jump or the pole vault or whatever, you know? I don't know about you, but I don't think I can jump over a bar that's this high. And yet I see athletes that will raise that bar up even higher and they do a run and jump over that thing. That's just crazy. Well, you lower the bar. Okay, I can jump over that. That's a lot easier. And we want to make it easier on ourselves and we want to minimize what is necessary and what God expects of us. And we see that and we're guilty of it so often, and we maybe at times where we don't even realize. And we've become so like the world in so many ways that that bar has lowered, and our concern for righteousness is not at the level where it needs to be. And we say that, well, this is good enough, or I'm doing good enough here. No. That's the problem the Pharisees had, and it's the same problem that we need to have. As he goes into... I'm sorry, go ahead, Adam.
So, also, I think it's important to point out that we have no capacity to raise or lower the bar. We can only...
Yeah, very good.
Imagine a scenario where a high jumper, you tell them, hey, the bar's at 3 feet, and they say, okay, and they don't jump very hard. Well, the bar was actually at 6 feet because it wasn't up to us whether we moved the bar or not. We just told them it was lower. And they crash into the bar and completely lost.
Right.
And that's what happens. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of the religious world that has good intentions with trying to lower the bar. I mean, they lower the bar in an ecumenicalist type of way. Like, we want everybody to go to heaven, and
right.
So we start thinking about these things in a different way. But in actuality, they're just telling everybody the bar's here when it might be higher, and everybody's just going to crash.
That's a good point. We don't have the ability to raise or lower the bar, is what Adam said. That bar is a constant. It's something that God set that we can't change. But we fool ourselves, we deceive ourselves in where it needs to be. And he used the word ecumenicalism. That's a big fancy word for all-inclusiveness. You know, everybody's good, everybody's okay. Doesn't matter what you believe, what you do, and so forth. Okay, we want to include everybody. Jesus was the furthest thing from ecumenical. He was extremely exclusive, very exclusive. And what I mean by that is that while he did want everybody to, of course, come to righteousness and go to heaven and so forth, while he desires that for everybody, he limits it to a very strict, narrow standard. And he is very blunt in saying that you have to meet this standard. And that's what he's saying here in verse 20, is that unless your standard of righteousness is up here, you're not going to enter into the kingdom. So we need to make sure that we are raising the bar in our minds to match where the bar actually is. Let's not be guilty of the same mistakes that the Pharisees were guilty of. Questions or comments before we continue? Right, right. Yeah, those two ways, the two gates that he talks about there in Matthew 7 illustrate that point. So the Pharisees were viewed by the people as being the most knowledgeable in the law. the most conservative students of the law. They were very well respected. And so they did not view them, the common people did not view the Pharisees as hypocrites or as charlatans. They viewed them as the people to whom they looked up to and that they were people to be emulated. And we may see the Pharisees, it's easy for us to see the Pharisees as hypocrites because we've seen what Jesus has said about them for years. And we've read that and studied that. But if you put yourself in the shoes of a first century Jew there in specifically Jerusalem, maybe, that's not the way you would have thought of the Pharisees. So Jesus is bringing something completely new and shocking to the people's ears. Remember, he's talking to his disciples. We saw that at the beginning of this chapter. He's got his disciples gathered around him, but the multitudes are there listening in. And he's saying their level of righteousness is not high enough. And he's putting, by implication, the scribes and Pharisees in the category of the publicans and sinners. That's the category that the Pharisees always referred to and thought Jesus was in that category. Really, Jesus is saying, no, y'all are in that category. From your previous studies of the response of the Pharisees to Jesus, what was one thing specifically about the publicans and sinners and Jesus, the way he interacted with them, what was it that they didn't like about that? What did they accuse him of quite often?
Basically, obtaining his garments.
Obtaining his garments in what way? What do you mean?
Spiritual, because you said you're supposed to separate yourself from these people, but that's what they accused him of the disciples of. But hey, he's over associated, he's going to wine, but he's just a party animal, just okay. All kind of stuff.
So they accuse him of associating with publicans and sinners, and specifically in what way? What was one event? The eating with them. In the sense that that's condoning them and being with them and participating even in their evil deeds. Not in the actual physical act of eating, but that's your groupies there, so to speak. Okay? Well, so would you say that Jesus catered to the sinners, to the publicans, to the prostitutes, to those that were looked down upon society? Would you say that he catered to them quite often in his ministry? Paid attention to them and gave them the time of day and helped them? Absolutely, Robbie. Yeah, and he called Peter and the rest of them to go out there and go after everybody. And so Jesus spent a lot of time with the lowlifes of society, but would you say that he catered to the Pharisees at all? Did he kowtow to them at all? While he did spend some time, obviously, in interaction and teaching them and talking to them, it was a completely different relationship. And because of that, because he did not look at the Pharisees and think of the Pharisees in the same way that the rest of the Jews did, that hurt their pride. And that caused them to view him with suspicion and to want to negate everything that he was saying. And so he's going to address that in verse 17 and following.
That's still confusing to me when you say he didn't cater to the Pharisees. Well, he had friends who were Pharisees. He catered to the people that agreed with the Pharisees. That sets them apart as having to be Sadducees. I don't believe that's the case. To me, the Pharisees had to be something of public service.
Let me try to clarify that. Not everybody was a Pharisee. Not everybody was a Sadducee. You didn't have to be one or the other. The Pharisees were more in tune with the common people. Most people would not necessarily align themselves or say, it's not like today where most people are going to say, well, I'm either a Republican or I'm a Democrat. Most people would not say, I'm a member of the Pharisaical sect or the Sadducean sect. But the Pharisees were more in tune and had a lot more in common with the common people. And so your regular, everyday Joe would probably be closer to the Pharisee teaching than the Sadducean teaching, but didn't necessarily make them a Pharisee. But then you had this other class of people, though, that would be the lowlifes, the sinners and publicans that nobody liked. Okay.
If you believed in heaven and a life hereafter, you didn't have to be a Pharisee, but you could have that belief.
Yeah. You could share some of the same beliefs, but not necessarily have taken it as far or been as active as the Pharisees. The Sadducees in Jesus' day were really the ones that held the public office. They were the ones that were the high council and so forth. The Pharisees were more amongst the common people. Terry?
You can kind of say that Jesus catered to those who both needed and wanted him the most.
Yes.
And he made that point, physicians, he doesn't go see those who are well, he goes to see those who are sick.
Right. But only those who are willing to see the physician and hear him and stuff. I mean, he certainly spoke to both groups of people, but he was not, here's my point, what I'm getting at. He was not going to give in to the Pharisees. He was not going to compromise, and he was going to lay it down for them because they were the hard-nosed, stubborn ones that were influencing the people and needed to be corrected. So with that in mind, take a look at verse 17. When he says, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets, I did not come to destroy but to fulfill. For assuredly, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled." I think the reason why he's having to say that is because in the Pharisees' mind, Jesus would be viewed as a lawbreaker. Jesus would be viewed as a rebel. And Jesus is saying, no, I'm not a lawbreaker. And in actuality, I'm fulfilling the law. I am the embodiment of the law. I am doing everything perfectly, and I am the fulfillment in the literal sense of a prophecy as well, and will accomplish all things of the law. And so this is somewhat of a defense here. I'm not a rebel. I didn't come to destroy the law of the prophets. He's not talking in this context about doing away with the old covenant and bringing in the new covenant. That's not the context. Okay. Did he do away with the old covenant? Yes. Is that same word abolish used to talk about the old covenant in other passages? Yes. But Jesus is not contradicting that point. He's just making a different point here. That he's not a rebel. He's not breaking the law. He's fulfilling it. And he's here to basically, as the rest of the sermon goes on, he's here to correct erroneous teachings about the law. And so the law is there. He's going to fulfill it. The jot and tittle. I think most of you probably know this, but that would be the little strokes, the smallest characters in the Hebrew language. One as small as like our apostrophe. I think that's the jot, if I remember correctly, or maybe it's the tittle. But and then the other one would be like a serif, those little extra parts of our letters that look fancy. Okay, so he said, not even one of those is going to pass away until all is fulfilled. Verse 19, whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. So he is extremely concerned about obeying the law and fulfilling the law. But he has to correct what has been taught to the people. Yes. Lisa says he's saying that as a lead up to what he's about to say. You've heard this, but I'm telling you this. Not changing it, but clarifying it, Lisa says. Since I spoke in the sermon about verses 21 through 26, I'm not going to talk about that here. But understand that that's where he starts, and the murder part, thou shalt not murder, again, they understood that, and that was right. But what they had wrong was the heart. and the anger that led up to the murder. And so he had to correct that. He's not saying you should not murder is a wrong thing. He's saying that leading up to that, the way you've been handling that, the internal part of the man, the heart, that's what needs to change. Okay, so let's skip down to verse 27. But before we do, any comments or questions?
What this starts out is, Jesus says, you've been interpreting my Father's words. The people in my Father's words, I'm telling you here, this is what needs to be said.
Yeah.
And theirs were part of the religion because they elevated themselves so much. People looked at them for everything. We tell you what to do, you do it. Now this guy says, Son of God, well, you know you're not the Son of God. Yeah.
And by the way, let me comment on the you have heard it said. Why would he use that kind of a phrase, you have heard it said? Okay. Well, but you've heard it said, and then he quotes something that is right. So that's correct. You've heard it said, you shall not murder. But the emphasis I wanted to focus in was on the hearing thing. In the first century, what's true of the vast majority of society? They can't read. It's very much an oral society. Oral, A-U-R-A-L, and oral, O-R-A-L. Okay, hearing and speaking. It's not so much reading. Those who can read and write are a very specialized group of people, small percentage of the population. And so most people were relying upon people like the Pharisees or the Sadducees to speak to them and teach them these things. And so that's why he's saying you have heard. And so the first one he has to correct is that of murder, which is really about anger. And then the next subject he addresses is adultery. But again, it's not the physical act of adultery that is the problem here. It's the lust, that's the heart, that starts the process of adultery. Verse 27, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. Again, straight from the Ten Commandments. That is correct. But I say to you, and here's where the difference would be. Here's where something new would be. Here's the level of righteousness that would exceed that of the Pharisees, of the scribes and Pharisees. The bar is up here, he says. I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. It's not just the physical act of adultery. It's what leads up to that. And whether or not you ever participate in the physical act is beside the point. His point is that you can be guilty of unrighteousness even if you're never guilty of the right of the act of adultery, the physical act of adultery. You can still be just as guilty because it's in the heart. Does that make sense? Everybody see that? Now he goes on to say in verses 29 and 30 about the extreme action that one needs to be willing to take in order to keep themselves from sin. About plucking out an eye or cutting off a hand or whatever the case may be. Just to illustrate the point, this is how serious it is. That this idea of making sure your heart is right, that your mind is right, is worth taking extreme actions to keep that from happening. What did Joseph have to end up doing with Potiphar's wife? He fled. Paul says in Timothy, flee sexual immorality. There are things that you've got to do to keep yourself from that particular sin. And here's where that bar can be lowered so easily. Guys, what are we tempted to do when we see a woman that we see is attractive, and maybe she is, you know, it really doesn't matter whether she is or not, but maybe in this particular circumstance, those shorts are showing a lot of leg, seeing the midriff, maybe she's showing some cleavage, whatever the case may be. We're tempted, are we not, guys, to say, well, I'm just appreciating her beauty. Don't we justify ourselves that way sometimes? Don't we rationalize that away? Are we going to be honest with ourselves here or not? Okay, this is where the bar is. Where is it? And are we willing to make the necessary steps or take the necessary steps in order to keep ourselves from situations that's going to cause us to sin or is going to highly tempt us to sin? I've said it before, that I refuse to, for me and my family to go to a water park. Okay, it's my personal and Lisa's personal judgment on that. I'm not saying that you're automatically sinning if you go to a water park. But I know that that puts me and my boys in a very, very dangerous situation because every single one of those girls, I say every, 99.9% of those people there are going to be showing way more than I need to be seeing. And I'm going to be guilty, likely, of violating this. Okay, that's the cutting off the hand thing. And I love water parks. You know, if we could do it FC Alabama camp style where everybody's wearing a dark shirt and knee-length shorts, great, let's do it. But that's not the way, you know, these water parks are. But that's our personal decision to give up that particular thing. Same thing with certain beaches or certain aspects of the beach and whatnot. We need to be careful about that. We need to make sure that our bar is where Jesus' bar is. Okay, and that we don't justify the way we're looking at a woman. And obviously the reverse is true as well. He uses the man here, but the reverse would be true. It's easy to justify the way we think. Comments, questions?
David's sin was not the fact that he saw Bathsheba the way
right.
He saw her. But that glance turned into
a longing look.
A longing, and that longing turned into lust, and the lust turned into sin.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess what they're asking you
yes.
Was,
you want to see more.
You're, yeah. You know, beginning to stare or whatever they call it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I could go off for hours about modesty here and the, you know, the, and there, but we'll do that some other time. But in this occasion, where's the responsibility? Is it on the woman or is it upon the man? It's on the man, regardless of what the woman is doing. I'm not saying the woman doesn't have any responsibility, far from it. But let's understand, it is our responsibility, guys, to make sure that our level of righteousness is such that we will turn away from those temptations.
You talk about, you know, standing there and staring and marveling at the beauty. I mean, that's different than standing there and staring at a shiny new Corvette. You know what I mean? There's a difference. You're not looking at the same thing.
Yeah. There may be some drooling going on over that new Corvette or that new bass boat, but that's where the similarities end. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's no surprise that immediately following this statement upon adultery in the heart, that he then follows it up with marriage and divorce. And we talked about this recently, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but basically what he gets down to is the fact that divorce is only allowable when there has been sexual immorality on one of the partners' part, verse 32. If you divorce your wife, and obviously the reverse would be true too, for any reason other than the fact that she or he has been unfaithful sexually to you, then marries another person, you are committing adultery. You have no right to be with that other person. And there was problems, of course, and we're going to see that we see this in Matthew 19 with the way the Jews thought of divorce and remarriage. And Jesus has to say, look, at one time, God was a long-suffering, and because of the hardness of your hearts, he allowed Moses to give a certificate of divorce, but that wasn't the way it was meant to be. And so it is time to set things right. And so one man, one woman for life. is basically the point here. Okay? All right, any final comments or questions before James rings that final bell? Okay, we're going to look beginning at verse 33 then. Next time we're going to be talking about oaths. We're going to talk about the way we respond to our enemies. And this would be very opposite of the way that things were being handled by the Jews in the first century at that time. All right, thank you.